Imagine you're like a global tech executive sitting in a major strategy meeting, right? And you're looking at the projections for India in 2026.
Oh, yeah. The boardroom conversations are completely changing right now.
They really are.
Okay.
Because you look at the screen and you see two completely contradictory numbers. On one hand, there's this punishing 40% standard tax rate for foreign companies.
Which is brutal, yeah.
Right. But then right next to it, there's a shockingly low 15% rate, but only if you agree to, pour concrete and actually manufacture locally.
Yeah, and that delta between those two numbers, I mean, that isn't an accident.
No, not at all.
It's a highly aggressive financial lever. It's completely designed to force your hand as an executive.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we're going to unpack today. Because if you're advising a client, or maybe leading a global expansion team, or really just trying to map out the professional realities of the geopolitical business landscape, you have to understand this dynamic.
You really do. It forces a completely different conversation because you are no longer just looking at a new geographic market to sell your products into.
Right.
You are being aggressively engineered into becoming a physical part of that country's industrial base.
Wow. Engineered into it. I like that phrasing.
Yeah, I mean, the traditional playbook where you keep all your operations safely at home and just, ship products across the border, that is functionally dead in this market.
It's totally dead. Which brings us to our ultimate shortcut for navigating this. We're doing a deep dive today into the newly released India Business and Compliance Guide 2026. This is put out by KNM India.
It's a fantastic resource.
It really is.
Yeah.
And our mission today is to, well, filter out all the dry legal jargon, right? We want to extract the high-level strategic roadmap. Like, what does a global firm actually need to know to successfully expand into India right now?
Yeah, because entering India today, it requires giving up traditional forms of centralized control. You're trading that in exchange for unprecedented speed and scale.
And that right there, the cost of control, that is the defining tension we're going to see over and over today.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we even get into the actual vehicles of how a firm crosses the border, we have to look at the physical landscape they're landing in.
The environment itself.
Exactly. I mean, the source highlights the obvious stuff, the surging middle class, urbanization, the whole make in India push. But the real structural shift, to me at least, seems to be these massive mega projects, Haramala and Sagarmala.
Oh, absolutely. Those two infrastructure initiatives are fundamentally altering the economic geography of the whole country.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Haramala is basically overhauling the entire national highway network, and then Sagarmala is modernizing all the coastal logistics and the ports.
I tend to look at these projects like very mechanically. If you consider a country's logistical capability as its economic bandwidth,
Oh,
right?
that's a good way to put it.
Thanks. Haramala and Sagarmala are essentially upgrading India from dial-up to fiber optic.
They really are. They're drastically reducing the physical latency of, moving a widget from a factory floor in Pune to a shipping container in Mumbai. You just aren't factoring in days of transport delays into your supply chain modeling anymore.
Right, the reduction in that physical latency is massive, but what's really fascinating, if we connect this to the bigger picture, is that the government is matching that with a huge reduction in regulatory
Oh,
latency.
you're talking about the DPIIT update.
Exactly. The K&M India Guide points to this pivotal shift from the DPIIT, that's the Department for Promotion of Industry and Internal Trade. This took effect in January 2026.
Right.
They moved significant sectors, especially critical infrastructure and green energy, entirely to the automatic route for foreign direct investment.
Okay, wait. Let's make sure the listeners grasp this, because moving those sectors to the automatic route, that effectively deletes what, like a 12 to 18 month bureaucratic waiting period?
Easily, sometimes longer.
That's incredible for anyone trying to deploy capital. I mean, you bypass the prior government approvals and the Reserve Bank of India checks entirely.
You just go.
But stepping back for a second, isn't that a massive risk for the Indian government? I mean, relinquishing oversight on billions of foreign capital flowing into critical infrastructure, that seems counterintuitive for a state that usually, tightly controls its borders.
It does seem that way, but it is a highly calculated risk. By putting green energy on the automatic route, the DPIIT is signaling a strategic global play. They want to make India the undisputed hub for renewable investment.
Right, because the scale of capital needed is just astronomical.
Exactly. They recognize that the global race for green energy dominance requires trillions. And friction is the enemy of capital.
Friction is the enemy of capital.
Yeah. So they are perfectly willing to trade that initial granular oversight for just the sheer velocity of incoming investment. They need that money fast to power the new infrastructure you were just talking about.
So you've got this high-speed physical network being built, and the regulatory gates have just been thrown wide open. That leads directly to the very next professional hurdle.
Choosing how you actually get in.
Exactly. You know the environment is primed, but what is the actual mechanism you use to plug into it? You have to choose your corporate vessel. And looking at the K&M guide, this is where that theme of the cost of control really crystallizes for me.
Because the legal entity you choose, it entirely dictates your risk profile, your liability, your speed to market, everything.
Right. And for a massive global firm, the primary divergence seems to be choosing between a joint venture and a wholly owned subsidiary.
Yeah, those are the two main paths.
But wait, from a purely fiduciary standpoint, a wholly owned subsidiary seems like the obvious default preference, right? We're taking 100% of your intellectual property, you aren't splitting profits, and you completely control the operational culture.
Sure.
So why would a multinational willingly dilute that control by entering a joint venture? I mean, giving up that much power seems crazy.
I get that, but in a hyper-localized market, owning 100% of a slow failure is infinitely worse than owning 51% of a rapid success.
Oh, wow. Okay, say more about that.
Well, think about what a wholly owned subsidiary actually entails. It means you are navigating land acquisition, local municipal permitting, deeply entrenched regional supply chains, all entirely from scratch. You are the outsider.
Right, you're starting at zero.
Exactly. A joint venture, sure, you sacrifice some equity, but it acts as a corporate skeleton key. You are instantly inheriting your local partner's established regulatory relationships. You get their existing factory floors, their deep distribution networks.
Ah, so if your mandate from the board back home is, like, capture market share in 6 months, not 6 years, the joint venture is literally the mechanism to buy that time.
Precisely. You are essentially buying localized intuition.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, but let's assume the firm decides their IP is just too sensitive or their long-term strategy demands total autonomy. The guide notes that the private limited company, the PVT LTD, is the overwhelming favorite for foreign investors setting up a subsidiary.
It is. Pragmatically speaking, the private limited company is the most efficient fortress you can build in India.
Fortress? How so?
It forcefully ring-fences the parent company's liability. The risk is legally isolated down to the specific share capital invested in that Indian entity.
Okay, so if the Indian operation faces a catastrophic lawsuit, or some massive regulatory fine, the global parent's assets back in, say, Germany or the U.S., they're completely shielded.
Exactly. Plus, the administrative friction is just incredibly low. You only need two directors and two shareholders to incorporate.
Which is a huge contrast to the public limited company, right?
Yeah.
That one demands a minimum of three directors and seven shareholders.
Yeah, and fundamentally, a public limited company is subjected to vastly more stringent public disclosure laws.
Because its primary function is to eventually raise capital via an IPO on the Indian exchanges, right?
Right. And you wouldn't burden a brand new manufacturing beachhead with IPO level compliance on day one.
You would completely suffocate your operational agility.
Completely. Now, there are scenarios where a firm doesn't even want the footprint of a subsidiary yet. They just want to test the waters.
Right, right. That is where branch offices and liaison offices come into play, according to the guide.
Exactly.
So a branch office is a direct legal extension of the parent company, and it can engage in actual commercial transactions, whereas a liaison office is strictly prohibited from generating any revenue whatsoever.
Not a single rupee, yeah.
But practically speaking, how does a global firm justify the cost of maintaining an office, staffing it, leasing space, if it legally cannot make a single dollar?
That's a great question. Think of a liaison office as a sovereign listening post.
Well, listening post, okay.
Yeah, it's purely an intelligence gathering and relationship building mechanism. You deploy a liaison office to scout supplier networks, map out competitor strategies, establish preliminary relationships with government regulators, all before you commit millions in capital.
Oh, so it's an operational scout.
Exactly. And then once you've mapped the terrain, you upgrade. You convert that intelligence into a private limited company.
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting. Because the moment that legal entity is registered, the conversation shifts aggressively to the balance sheet. And this brings us back to that jarring 40% versus 15% dynamic we opened the show with.
Yes, the tax funnel.
Right. So the standard corporate income tax, the CIT, for a foreign company is 40%, and that's compared to 30% for a domestic Indian company.
It is a punitive base rate, absolutely, but it exists solely to make the alternative irresistible.
Which is the loophole.
Right. The February 2026 union budget rationalized the corporate tax down to roughly 15%, but only for new manufacturing units set up post-April 2026.
Wait. If they're dropping the tax rate by more than half for these manufacturing entities, how on earth is the government offsetting that massive loss in domestic revenue? Are they just, like, banking on sheer volume over a decade?
They're banking on the multiplier effect of the physical ecosystem.
Okay, explain that.
When a foreign firm builds a manufacturing plant just to get that 15% rate, they don't just pour concrete and leave. They hire local logistics firms. They source raw materials from domestic suppliers. They hire thousands of workers.
And those workers pay income tax. They buy consumer goods.
Exactly. The Indian government is perfectly willing to lose 25 points on the corporate tax margin if it means permanently anchoring a global supply chain within their borders. It's a behavioral economics masterclass.
Wow. That makes perfect sense. They're monetizing the secondary economic activity rather than just taxing the corporate profit directly.
Exactly. And they are accelerating that even further with the production-linked incentive schemes, the PLIs. The 2026 budget expanded those heavily, especially into electronics.
Yeah, the guide mentions the PLIs. Mechanically, a PLI acts like a massive subsidy that scales with your ambition, doesn't it?
It does. It fundamentally alters the math of global supply chain modeling. They don't just offer you a tax break. They actively pay you a percentage based on your incremental sales of goods manufactured in India.
So if you manufacture, say, 1 million smartphones, your per unit cost drops, not just because of economies of scale, but because the government is actively wiring you capital for hitting that output metric.
Right. And there's always a but. You still have to navigate the structural complexities of the broader tax system.
Yeah.
Like MAT, NE, and GST.
Oh, right. Let's talk about MAT. Minimum alternate tax. Mm. The guide flags this as crucial for capital-heavy industries.
It is. Often, a massive manufacturing setup will have immense depreciation write-offs in its early years, right? Which technically reduces its taxable corporate profit to zero.
Right. On paper, they aren't making money.
On paper. MAT ensures that if your book profits show you are actually a healthy operating company, you still pay a minimum baseline tax. It prevents high capex firms from using clever accounting mechanisms to operate tax-free indefinitely.
Got it. And then there's the dual goods and services tax, the GST, which involves both a central GST and a state GST. Structurally, the whole implementation of GST was meant to unify India into a single market, right? Because previously, moving goods across state lines within India was basically like crossing international borders.
Oh, it was a logistical nightmare. You paid entry taxes, there were physical checkpoints at state borders.
Yes.
It was chaos.
Right. And the dual GST system replaced that chaos. But the guide makes it clear that it requires highly sophisticated compliance software now.
It does. Your enterprise resource planning, your ERP system, has to seamlessly split and route the tax to both the federal government and the specific state government the exact moment a transaction occurs.
And speaking of compliance infrastructure, that leads us to another major financial variable, the digital services tax, or the equalization levy. The K&M guide notes that further clarity on this is expected in the upcoming 2026 budget.
Yeah, this is a big one for tech.
If you're a global software provider or a cloud infrastructure company, and you don't have a massive physical footprint in India, this equalization levy is the mechanism the government uses to ensure they still capture tax revenue from the digital value you are extracting from Indian consumers, right?
Exactly. Which perfectly illustrates the transition we're seeing. Paying your corporate tax is no longer the finish line.
Right.
The definition of corporate risk has evolved significantly by 2026. The new moats in India are built entirely out of digital and ethical compliance.
So what does this all actually mean for the C-suite listening right now? It means compliance isn't just some secondary legal function anymore. It is the core architecture of your market entry.
Absolutely.
Let's look at ESG, environmental, social, and governance. The guide details that SEBI, the securities regulator there, is enforcing much stricter ESG disclosure requirements effective mid-2026. Like, compliance used to be checking a box. Now it's like passing a rigorous daily health inspection.
What's fascinating here is the inversion of global power dynamics.
How do you mean?
Historically, a Western multinational would establish an outpost in a developing market and simply operate according to its own home country ESG standards because those were generally much higher.
Right, you'd bring your standards with you.
Right. That era is over. India is no longer importing global standards. They are setting their own highly aggressive, hyper-local ESG baselines.
Meaning a global firm can't just, you know, attach their standard corporate sustainability PDF to their Indian regulatory filings.
Absolutely not. The mid-2026 SEBI mandates require you to integrate your supply chain transparency directly into the Indian reporting framework.
Wow.
You have to prove under Indian regulatory standards that your localized operations aren't violating regional water usage metrics or local labor equity standards. You are bending to their framework, not importing your own.
And if ESG is the physical oversight, then the Digital Personal Data Protection Act of 2023, the DPDP Act, is the digital oversight.
Yeah, the DPDP Act is huge.
It's fully operational now, and it completely rewrites the rules on data localization. Because I think a lot of professionals assume data localization just means, you know, renting server space in Mumbai. But the guide makes it clear it is much deeper than that.
Oh, it is. The mechanics of the DPDP Act are rigorous. It mandates explicit, verifiable consent for data collection. But more importantly, it severely restricts cross-border data transfers.
So a global tech firm cannot just arbitrarily harvest user data in Delhi, route it through a server in Singapore, and process it for some algorithm in California.
No. The legal friction there is massive now. If you want to move that data, you need explicit localized consent, and the government can block transfers to certain countries entirely.
So you are basically forced to build localized data centers and process the intelligence domestically.
Exactly. You can't just operate from a cloud in California. And accompanying this digital strictness is a really heavy emphasis on ethical operations through the Prevention of Corruption Act.
Right, the anti-bribery frameworks. The guy points out these are no longer just internal HR policies.
Not at all. The legal liability for corrupt practices now extends deep into the corporate hierarchy.
Really? How deep?
Well, if a local vendor hired by your joint venture engages in a bribe just to speed up a municipal permit, the global parent company's directors can face severe legal exposure back in India.
Wow. So robust, localized compliance auditing isn't optional. It's a mandatory operational cost.
It is the cost of doing business.
Okay, so let's recap where we are. You have the physical entity chosen. You've got the tax strategy optimized for that sweet 15% rate. The digital localization infrastructure is built, and the ESG reporting is aligned.
The machine is built.
Right, we've structured the entire machine. But a machine doesn't run itself. The final variable for professional advising on this expansion is the human element. Managing human capital in India under the 2026 framework requires navigating what looks like a dual-track labor strategy.
It is a dual-track strategy, yeah. The K&M guide details that the new labor codes have really modernized the employment landscape. But the non-negotiable reality for any foreign firm is immediate integration into the national social security apparatus.
You're talking about the mandatory contributions to the Provident Fund, the PF, and the Employees State Insurance Corporation, ESIC.
Exactly.
Because you can't just offer a high base salary and a nice private health plan.
Right.
Right. You have to physically route a percentage of payroll into these state-managed funds to ensure that domestic workforce has a guaranteed safety net.
Right. And your compliance software has to handle this flawlessly or the penalties are severe.
But here is the irony that really stuck out to me in the guide. Managing that local HR requires understanding entirely new, strict labor codes. But at the same time, bringing in expats is getting easier.
Yes. That's the other half of the dual-track strategy. Those frameworks we just mentioned, they protect the domestic worker. But the government also recognizes that foreign firms need to deploy their own executive leadership or, you know, specialized engineers to actually stand up these massive facilities.
Right. You need the talent to build the factory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So while they are heavily regulating domestic labor standards, the guide points out that work visa rules and immigration processes have been intentionally eased for highly skilled expat workers.
That is honestly a brilliant piece of statecraft.
Isn't it?
They are forcing the foreign company to heavily subsidize the social safety net of the Indian middle class through PF and ESIC. But simultaneously, they're removing the immigration friction so that same company can easily fly their top German engineers or American executives to ensure the factory actually gets built in the first place.
They are importing the global expertise required to build the infrastructure while ensuring the economic benefits of that infrastructure are securely locked into the local populace. It's an incredibly sophisticated approach to managing globalization on their own terms.
Yeah, it really is. All right, let's synthesize the roadmap we just covered today.
Yeah.
If you're building a strategy for the Indian market in 2026, you are not dealing with a static puzzle.
No, it's moving fast.
You are dealing with an ecosystem moving at fiber optic speeds, thanks to Paratmala and Automatic Route FDI. You have to actively decide how much control you are willing to trade for speed when you're choosing between a joint venture or a private limited company.
Yep.
You have to restructure your entire supply chain to capture the 15% manufacturing tax rate and those POI subsidies. And you must architect an entirely localized compliance framework to survive the DPDP Act and the mid-2026 ESG mandates.
And because the mechanical complexity of those tax codes and localization laws is so incredibly high right now, the overriding takeaway from the K&M India guide is that attempting this expansion without deeply integrated local counsel is essentially corporate malpractice.
Wow. Corporate malpractice.
Truly, the risk of misinterpreting the dual GST routing or messing up a data localization mandate, it's simply too high.
The environment demands absolute precision, and it changes the way we have to think about international expansion entirely.
You know, this raises an important question for anyone listening who works in global strategy.
Okay, let's hear it.
We've spent this entire time analyzing India's specific tactics, right? The 15% manufacturing lure, the strict data localization moats, the hyper-local ESG mandates.
Right.
But what if India isn't an anomaly?
What do you mean?
What if their 2026 regulatory framework is actually the new operational blueprint that other emerging massive economies across Africa or Southeast Asia are going to start copying?
Oh, wow.
If this highly demanding localized compliance model becomes the global standard, will the most dominant multinational companies of the next decade be the ones with the best products, or simply the ones with the most adaptable corporate DNA?
That is a phenomenal point to end on. Because the cost of entry is clearly no longer just capital. It is total operational adaptation. Keep that in mind the next time you look at a global map. That's our deep dive into the realities of the Indian market in 2026. Take this analysis, stress test your current strategies, and you'll be prepared for the boardroom.